We're happy to welcome back to the program on the telephone line right now, Steve Buckley of The Athletic. Hello there, Buck.
How are you doing up in Maine, sir?
Wonderful. It is a gorgeous day here. We've had a lovely stretch of weather, and it's not even summer yet.
I was just telling the gentleman who called me the exact same thing. It's just here today that I regret a little bit. I love what I do for a living, but I regret that I'm sitting in my office banging away on this computer. So what are you going to do?
Well, exactly. I want to talk Red Sox with you, but first, I don't know if you saw this, but Rick Lashua has been named, will be inducted this fall into the University of Maine's Sports Hall of Fame.
That's awesome. So I just want it noted for the record that you brought up the 1980s University of Maine baseball team in this case, not me, because I know I have a habit of throwing down that path. So congratulations to Rick, though.
I had to bring it up. I always love to bring it up when you're on with us here.
There you go.
It was a great time. Obviously, we're pretty partial to those 80s Maine baseball teams here, but you know, really in all of New England, times were different. You could get to the College World Series from the Northeast in those days, and that always made it so much more exciting.
Yeah, and I remember, I forget which player told me this, but that the formula was that Wink basically had to get like every good player in Maine and one or two top kids from somewhere else. And so you'd look at, you know, Billy Swift out of South Portland and Rick Lashua and Pete Adams, Stu Lockinator out of Portland, on and on. But there'd always be like Kevin Buckley in Braintree, Mass, Joe Johnson, who was from, I think, Plainville, Mass. I forget which town.
I think so, yeah.
But he'd always have that stud kid from Massachusetts or Long Island or someplace, and that was the formula, plus his great coaching and the fan base, and there you are.
How many years did you cover those Maine teams?
Just two. They've been, you know, two better years, 82 and 83, and they went to Omaha both times, and then Jordan Culbertz got the AAA team in Old Orchard Beach, and I did the guides, and then I was off to Seattle, so I mean, there's no doubt if you look at my timeline that all the stuff I did later on grew out of doing the Black Bears for a couple of years and then the guides. So, I mean, it's just like from here to there to there. And without the here and the there, you know, who knows where I'm going. But, yeah, the whole foundation is the Black Bears for me.
Well, let's talk a little Boston Red Sox. Another exciting win last night. And this is one of those teams that whatever happens at the end, they're at least fun to watch. You get excited about them. At least I know I do. And guys like Christian Arroyo, somewhat unheralded, who come up with these big hits time and time again.
You know, I'm glad you said that because I don't want to say problems with the Boston teams winning all these championships the last 20 years. That obviously is not a problem. It would be stupid to put it that way. We've had an abundance of riches, an embarrassment of riches over the last 20 years. But it's okay just to watch a darn game and have fun watching it and not get too wedded to the notion that if it doesn't lead to a championship, that all is not worth living. And, I mean, that's the way. I don't know about what your growing up process was, but mine was, I just loved watching baseball. I loved watching Bobby Orr at the Bruins and Havlicek and Russell with the Celtics when I was a little kid. And, you know, the early Pats teams at Fenway Park. I just loved watching sports. And last night, because I wasn't writing off the game, I had a friend over. There was pizza involved. And I'm not going to lie to you. I watched the first three innings of the Mets game because, you know, Jake
DeGrom. Well, I watched DeGrom, yeah.
And he had, eight strikeouts in three innings, came out with the shoulder thing. And, you know, a buddy of mine, we had formed a pact. We were going to watch DeGrom as long as DeGrom was relevant and then switch to the Red Sox. So it was a very entertaining night of watching baseball. And, you know, yes, the Red Sox won, yay team and all that. But what some of the things that happened in that game were a lot of fun. And I think that it's okay just to have fun. That's the point I'm trying to make here.
I mean, we're about the same age. I mean, the year that turned it all around for me, I watched the Red Sox when I was about 7 or 8 years old when Tony C was the guy to cheer for. But the 67 season is what locked me in. But then it was a bit of a long drought until 1975. And there were some years when you knew in August that there wasn't going to be any postseason. It didn't matter. I hung in there and I watched every game. Same thing with the Jim Plunkett Patriots in the day. You watch because they were your team.
Yeah, and when my early days of baseball, and I kind of wandered into it because my older brothers and my older sister were huge Red Sox fans. So it was a topic of ongoing concern and jubilation in the house from the time my earliest days. And I knew the Red Sox were lousy in the early 60s. I knew they were lousy. And I just figured, well, that's just the way it is because they're not the Yankees. The Yankees were winning all the pennants in those days. And at that early stage of my life, I just was very excited about going to a Red Sox game. I think I was 8 when I went to my first Sox game in 1964. And, you know, and I could tell you the same story about walking up the ramp and the green grass and the wall and, you know, and all that, because that's all true. But, boy, 67, it just like it was an explosion of excitement. And and that never left me. And obviously now I do it for a living, and there's a certain professional detachment that's required. But that doesn't mean I can't love the game, too. And so, yeah, my roots in baseball clearly are in line with yours with the 67 Red Sox.
I used to go, I think the first game I went to in person was in 68, and I had a great uncle who was a chef at the Fenway Motor Inn that used to be right next to the ballpark, but that was where some of the visiting teams stayed. So we would go in there because there was a pretty good chance that you could get an autograph, and it didn't matter what team it was, but I remember being thrilled out of my socks to get, I think it was Curt Bleffery's autograph and Wally Bunker's.
Now, where was the Fenway Motor Inn?
I think it's where the Howard Johnsons ended up being later.
Oh, right on Boylston.
Yeah.
Okay, because I, you know, Eddie Popowski, who was the third base coach of the Red Sox, he lived there. And I know that because me and some of the local kids were at a game getting autographs, and he came out, and we walked with him all to that Howard Johnson's on Boylston Street and you know, talked with him and stuff. And then years later, when I was, you know, he was in his 80s, he'd be like a minor league instructor with the Red Sox, and I got to know him in spring training, and this was as recently as like 20, 25 years ago, and I would talk to him, and he said, oh, I lived there for years, because it was, you know, he was a coach, he wasn't making big money, he probably had a deal with the team, and that was where he lived his entire time with the Red Sox when he was in the big leagues.
Yeah, those the more accessible times, I miss that. And I'm sure for you, too, I used to get down to spring training when I was first in radio back in the mid to late 70s. It was college break for me, so I would get a press pass and go. But in those days, as you'll remember, you go to Winter Haven, Chain of Lakes Park, there were maybe 800 people there, and you could walk out and talk to players. It was not the attraction that it's become.
There was a day around 1970 when Joe DiMaggio, if you look it up, 1 or 2 years, was a coach with the Oakland A's. And as it happened, I think he did that because that gave him an extra year that had something to do with his pension. Mm. And DiMaggio always had an eye for those kinds of things. So anyway, he was a coach. And we're at a game. He walks out of Fenway. He's got, you know, he's a very handsome man with the silver hair and a beautiful suit. And he walked down Jersey Street, took a right onto Brookline Avenue, walked over that bridge down into Kenmore Square and took a right. We're following him, me and two or three kids. And he took a right into Kenmore Square to the Somerset Hotel, which is now the Hotel Commonwealth. And that's where a lot of teams stayed in those days. And we followed him right into the lobby, and we're dying to ask him for his autograph, but we're too scared. He walks up to the elevator. It's a true story. He walks up to the elevator, presses the button, he steps in, and just as the door is closing, I summon the courage to say, Mr. DiMaggio, can I have your autograph? And as the door is closing, it's so dramatic, as the door is closing, he says, take a hike. And the door closes, and the moment is gone. And all of a sudden, I hear a voice, my buddy's, and he says, hey, come here. And there's a guy, young guy, sitting on a chair in the hotel lobby. And he said, what did he say? And he said, he told me to take a hike. And he says, wow, if Joe DiMaggio tells you to take a hike, you best be taking a hike then, right? It was Vital Blue.
Oh, wow.
He was like 21, 22 years old. And I know that because we knew he was a player and we got his autograph. And and it's like that like goofy moment you have when you're a kid that you crossed with Vida Blue and Joe DiMaggio in a hotel lobby in Kenmore Square.
See, my brush with fame, much less exciting than that, but I was standing outside the player's gate. I was about 12 or 13, and this little red sports car came out, and I realized it's Bob Montgomery.
Oh, there you go.
And I say, "Hey, Monty," and he flipped a cigarette at me and drove off.
Have you had him on your show to run that by him?
No, I have not, but Someday I will.
Did you, like, during the years that he was doing the Sox on TV, had you made your peace
him
emotionally?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, it's like Yaz when I was in college and stupid, and I was down in spring training, and I asked Yaz for an autograph after a spring training game, and he looked at me and said, "What are you a reporter or a fan?" I didn't really have a good answer for that at that point. He said,
in the middle.
Right. He said, "Let me do my sprints."
Yeah.
Years later, he came up here to do some TV commercials, and I told him the story, and he said, "Yeah, that sounds about right. What were you thinking?"
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny because not to sell my wares here, but I just wrote a column in The Athletic the other day on they're putting up statues out at UMass for Jack Lehman and John Calipari. And by way of introduction in the column, I mentioned that I'm not a big fan of erecting statues to living people, that we should wait until the record is complete. And by way of introduction in the column, I pointed out that I was there. Shaughnessy McGlobe and me were both covering it, I think it was in 13, when they unveiled the statue of Yaz outside on Van Ness Street. And Yaz was so emotional and revealed so much of himself that morning. And as you can attest, he was always very reserved and close to the vest. And here he's talking about his son dying and how he wished his son could be here that day and so forth. And his son being the father of the current Giants outfielder, Mike Yastrzemski.
Right.
And it really changed my outlook on you know, maybe in some cases it's okay to put up statues with the people, because it clearly meant a lot to Yaz. And he revealed so much of himself that day and opened up and stood around talking to people and signing autographs. And he was in a very emotional but very good place. And so when you mentioned Yaz from back in the day, I covered Yaz when I was at the Press Herald in Portland. I'd make trips down to Boston, and I was always afraid of him because he was very he would sit with his back to the clubhouse, to the mob that was in there, and then at some juncture he would stand up, turn around, fold his arms, and everyone would get up and talk to him, and he'd answer everybody's questions and be available and so forth. And then he would say, "All right, that's it," and sit back down and light up a cigarette. And once he did that, you didn't bother him anymore. And that's just the way he was.
Yeah, and I found when I worked with him a little bit, when he came up to do some commercials, and he was a very shy, guarded guy. But you know, when he could kick back and have a cigarette and you know, maybe a little wine and play cribbage, he was great.
Yeah, I put him in a group with a select group of people who really, really, really had to work for what. And it's funny because you wouldn't think in a million years you'd make this comparison, but Randy Moss, when he played for the Patriots, just seemed when he was just seemed so serious and balled up, because Randy always struck me as a really bright guy when it came to like breaking down the nuances of football and doing what needed to be done. And for some strange reason, I would think of Yaz sometimes when I talked to Randy Moss. Randy was a lot more, you know, quotable and so forth. But Yaz was one of those guys that really had to put a lot of work into his effort. Mm.
We're talking with Steve Buckley on Downtown. Speaking of The Athletic, I loved your piece on the 20th anniversary of Ray Bourque bringing the Stanley Cup back to Boston, and fascinating conversations you had with both Ray Bourque and Harry Sinden.
I'm very, very thankful that both of those wonderful people agreed to talk with me, and not just to talk to me, but to do so with a measure of candor. Ray wasn't crazy about the idea. I think I kind of lucked out because I called Harry first. And Harry was was, yeah, sure. And he's 88. You'd think he was 58. He's as clear-headed and well-spoken as he ever was. And we did the whole thing over the phone. And I think I just caught him when he was probably sitting at the kitchen table having a cup of coffee. Yeah, sure, you know. And because I had already talked to him, then I called Ray. And again, I've had a relationship with both of these guys over the years. And I think if I had done it in the other way, if I had called Ray first, I think Ray would have said no. And then I would have been calling Harry and then calling Ray back. Well, Harry, I think because Harry did it first, and I was able to say to Ray, well, you know, I talked to Harry for 45 minutes. And he said, oh, really? What did he say? And I told him, and he kind of chuckled. And it was off to the races. So I was very fortunate the way that played out. And it's a good piece. And I can say that because I didn't really write it. I wrote it as an oral history. So when I say it's a good piece, it's not like, you know, my craft and my handiwork and all that. It really is an oral history where I let them do all the talking. All I did was chronicle what they said and put it in the right order. And it's a fun piece.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Check it out on The Athletic. What's the status of the old-time game?
Thank you for asking. We're going to have a boiled-down version of the game on Monday, August 23rd, I think it is, whatever that is. And I just got word from the city the other day because everything in Cambridge has to go through the health department because COVID and some of the old rules are still in place. So we're having a low-key game. I'm purposely not inviting any quote-unquote celebrities. You know, we had Roger Clemens 2 years ago. We had Ray Bourque 2 years ago. Ray came solely to get in that bat against Tim Wakefield. The year before that, we had Pedro Martinez, which is the biggest crowd we ever had. We've had Oil Can Boyd. We've had, you know, just Jim Lonborg pitch an inning 1 year at age 73 and somehow retire the side without allowing a run. So we're not doing that this year. We're going to just have the players, the uniforms, a sort of a low. And we're doing that more just to get our gang, our crowd, our people back together again, and just to see where we are and stage the game this year, just to sort of lay the groundwork for next year. We're going to do a thing. We haven't really done anything with Pete Frady since he died, the ALS champion from BC. So we'll be doing that this year, and we're going to invite a lot of Pete's old friends, teammates, to play in the game. We usually get a guy from Maine. I know we had the son of Mark Powers, the former Maine pitcher, and I Mark when he was still in Babe Ruth ball in 1981 when I was first hired by the Press Herald. I covered the New England Babe Ruth tournament, and Mark pitched a perfect game against Rhode Island in the New England championship game. And then years later, somebody from Maine emailed me to tell me that his son, I think his name was Sean or Scott, I forget, pitched a perfect game for Southern New Hampshire University. And that person knew that I covered his father's game. So we invited the son to pitch an inning in our game, and Mark came down from Maine, and I got to see him and meet him for the first time since his Maine days.
Oh, that's great.
So that's kind of a big tangent, but we'll probably have somebody from Maine. We usually do.
Well, that's awesome. Well, I'm glad the game is coming back in some fashion in August. So excellent news there. Buck, it's always good to talk with you. Thanks so much for making time this afternoon, and we'll do it again before too long.
It's always a pleasure. Take care of yourself.
Steve Buckley of The Athletic on Downtown.